This is a Glass Box Media podcast.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to This Week in Travel, the show that talks to some of the most interesting and notable travelers in the world. Learn about the top travel stories from the world of travel, get valuable travel tips, and have some fun in the process. Now here are your hosts, Gary Arndt and Jen Leo.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of This Week in Travel. My name is Gary Arndt, coming to you from a slightly above average temperature, Wisconsin, where the leaves are finally starting to change, fallen from the trees. With me again, as usual, from the place where the weather never changes, Jen Leo. How are you doing, Jen?
Doing great, Gary. It's getting kind of chilly in Carlsbad. It's 70 degrees Fahrenheit. A little chilly for us.
Yeah, you don't get to talk about that. That's not cold.
I'm just messing with you.
I think it hit 70 here yesterday, believe it or not. So it's not been hot or anything. It's just been sort of not cold. It's like been in the 60s, which is kind of above average for this kind of year.
Well, I know you've been traveling, so I'm very excited to hear more about your travels.
Yeah, you could say that. We'll be talking about that. Returning to the show, it's been quite a while. She's a lawyer, flight attendant, blogger, a podcaster, and now an author. She just came out with a brand new book, Secret Seattle. Please welcome back Mary Jo Manzanares. How are you doing, Mary Jo?
Hi, Gary. Good to talk with you again. I saw you just a few days ago. And Jen, I haven't talked with you in forever.
Ages. But I'm so excited that you guys are hot off the heels of the SATW conference. So I can't wait to hear about it.
Good. We'll be happy to talk about it.
Well, let's talk about that first. I mean, we'll have plenty of time to talk about the book, if only because this is the first conference that I've been to in a year and a half, depending on how you want to define it. I guess it's probably the same for you as well, Mary Jo, right?
Well, yeah, definitely the first conference. We've done a few selected travels, but the first time I actually was with a good group of people and a good sized group of people in a professional organization.
Yeah, so we were in Milwaukee for the Society of American Travel Writers annual convention. Was supposed to be there last year, got canceled, obviously. They did it again this year. There were about 200 plus people there, I think. I think that was like the final number, which I felt was actually a pretty good turnout for, you know, everything that's been happening. And it was a pretty good time.
Yeah, I thought it was a good group of people. I'm not sure what the final numbers were, but everyone, you know, is just at different risk tolerance levels about getting back together. So I think it was a great job pulling it off, and it was really a delight to see people again.
200 people, that's a good show for these days, I would say.
Yeah, that's what I said. I was kind of surprised. And everybody, you know, I was talking to a lot of people about their stories because there were some people from PR firms and everyone there. And, you know, I can bellyache about all the problems I've had from the pandemic. But when you go to a travel conference, you can't really, you know, you can't really complain because everyone, it's been miserable the last year and a half. I was talking to people that work for really good sized PR firms and they were all, you know, yeah, we had to lay all these people off. We had to take salary reductions. I haven't been anywhere. We lost clients. Wow. Same story for everyone. So it's not like, you know, I had anything, you know, unique. Everyone was kind of in the same boat. And I think everyone's now just trying to figure out, all right, where do we go from here? Because travel is happening. There are people traveling. I'm sure we all, you know, have done it or people are doing it. But it's still not like it was before. And that's probably going to be a while.
I thought it was going to be a Misery Loves Company sob session. But what I found really encouraging is talking to people about how they're pulling out of things. And everyone's and every destination's in a different phase of that. But I felt very encouraged talking with people that while it's a ways away from normal, there just seems to be a path.
One of the things I found interesting was a lot of these companies, obviously, they laid people off or they furloughed them. And then people went and did other things. They found other jobs. And now when they're in a position to start rehiring, those people aren't available. And so they're having to increase wages. There's competition for people between competing firms. And it's a very different environment than it was 2 years ago. Very different.
Gary, are you just talking about travel PR agencies, or are you also talking about tourist boards?
Both. The difference being that a lot of the everyone has been hurt by this. Some of the I would say there were more PR people there than tourist boards, simply because a lot of the tourist boards have travel restrictions that are put in place by government organizations. So they weren't necessarily able to attend, or they had bigger budget problems. And a lot of the tourism boards, or the CVBs, they're funded, most of them, by like hotel taxes. And so that means that there's a lag between when travel comes back, people are filling hotel rooms, and they get funding. So I think a lot of them are still kind of in a really bad shape, and maybe the PR firms are kind of coming back first because they have private sector clients that they can work with in addition to some destinations. But on the other hand, there are some destinations that came through this relatively fine, like a national tour board, depending on the country, because the way they're funded was very different. So
that's interesting. Were there any case studies or any companies, whether they were agencies or even some of the writers, whatever side you were on, were there any that succeeded during this time? Like they completely just sort of pivoted. Were there any success stories besides yourself, Gary?
I was just going to say, I wouldn't say that I succeeded, but I've made a big change. I don't know of anyone else that's made a really big change. It's mostly stories of survival. If you're in the travel business or travel media, it just wasn't money, consumers' interest available for the last year and a half. And so it's very hard to stick with what you were doing and succeed when there was, the demand simply fell off a cliff. Mm-hmm. So I can't think of anyone, Mary, unless you can, think of anything.
There weren't any destinations that sort of found a very small niche traveler, like maybe RV travel or campgrounds. Was KOA there again? Like anything like that?
Boy, nothing jumps out at me. I don't think anyone did major pivots. And I think for a long time, people thought the pivot was going to be virtual events. But once Zoom fatigue set in, I think that was no longer seen as a pivot. So I think people may have had small successes. But with the exception of Gary, I don't know anyone who made a huge pivot and it forging a new success path.
The only thing I can think of that and had nothing to do with this conference is I just know of several bloggers that have launched new websites that are destination specific. Yeah. Kaz and Craig Make Peace. They had their Why Travel blog, and then they launched one for a site for the Raleigh Durham area. Tom Bartel and Chris Henning, they launched a site for visiting Minnesota. So I think more people are doing destination-specific sites, the generic travel blog, because if you look at what most people are doing now anyways, it's all just SEO content. That's all it is. No one actually goes to a website to read it anymore. That's just not a thing. No one's writing opinion pieces. It's just keyword researched SEO articles. So if you're going to do that, you might as well just create a site that's about a destination so you can rank well for that. And I think that's what a lot of people are doing. And that makes sense, I think, if you're going to go down that path.
Did any of the writers talk about that? Did they talk about the future of travel literature or where we saw that going? Did any newspapers shrink? Like, did any did we lose a number of travel newspaper sections? Did we lose anybody?
Let me put it this way. I there weren't a lot of sessions about that topic, at least none that I sat in. I can say this. You know the Lowell Thomas Awards?
Yes. So
they give those out, and, you know, for excellence in travel writing. And it used to be they had, I think, four different categories of newspaper.
By circulation.
Right. Yeah. Well, now there's one category for all newspapers, and there were five entries. And they gave out four awards. Well, so
they gave out four awards. Okay, that's wrong for giving four awards.
No, because it's like, who's the fifth? Like, it's not who won. I'm like, okay, who was the one that didn't make it?
I don't know, but whoever didn't win, we need to have them on the show. Who won?
I don't know. It's like going to a soccer match for 6-year-olds. Everybody gets a trophy at that point. I've just been appointed to the board of directors for the SATW Foundation that oversees the Lowell Thomas Awards. And I'm sure this is something that we're going to have to bring up because it's also true with magazines as well. There just aren't as many travel magazines anymore. So
who was the SATW president this year? And do they get did they get 2 years to make up for last year or how did that work?
No, Paul Lasley just finished and the new president is now Elizabeth Harriman.
Oh, okay. So, that's
Larry Bleiberg just finished. Not Paul Lasley.
Oh, you know, yeah, Paul. I was going to say Paul was Elizabeth's husband and Paul just passed away and Paul was on the show. Elizabeth, we've had Paul on the show in the past and Paul was a big, you know, force in travel radio, especially in Southern California. I think it's been it was 2 weeks ago that he passed away. And so Elizabeth obviously wasn't there. She's still dealing with that, but she's going to be the incoming president. And Paul was the SATW president several years ago, but you're right. Larry Blythe was the president.
Elizabeth. Okay. Well, that's a big blow.
Yeah, that's sort of the reaction of a lot of people, just sort of speechless about what to say.
And as far as the future of travel journal, there weren't a lot of sessions explicitly on that. And I think everyone's still kind of figuring stuff out because, I think a lot of people, when this all started, I thought this was going to be done in a month back in March of 2020. Yeah, that's how wrong I was. And then everyone was like, oh, well, you know, next year it'll be better. And I think people are now realizing it probably isn't going to get back to normal maybe until 2023, at least as far as numbers and stuff like that. And then that as far as spending on advertising and marketing and other things like that, Lord knows when that's going to happen. So it's going to be a while. And I think, and everyone realizes this, we're going to come out of this a very different business than we went in. That could manifest itself in a bunch of different ways. I think you're going to still see more. And, you know, these are trends that are affecting every business. People working remotely, I think that's going to be more of a thing. I think in a lot of PR, it probably doesn't matter where you work unless you have to meet with your client. And even that, a lot of that can be done remotely. We'll see. I personally think that a lot of the we're well past peak social media. That is something that I don't think people are going to be clamoring about as much anymore because it was always, what's the next big thing? I did a session there on podcasting.
Yeah, I think that's fantastic.
You know, we've been doing this show for 12 years. And it's only recently, maybe in the last few months, that people are now starting to reach out to us to try to get on the show as guests and stuff. That never really happened before. I think people are now starting to see the value in it. They're starting to see the value in longer form, more engaging content, which is, you know, what podcasting is. So there was a lot of positive feedback for my session. I kind of wish more people had shown up, But I think people are now beginning to realize that it's a thing. So, but we'll see. I don't really know what's going to happen going forward.
So I guess maybe this is more of a TBEX thing, and Society of American Travel Writers is at a different level. But I think there's going to – I think there is room as the space gets tighter and maybe people shift and turn to other jobs or other passions. I think there is a space for sort of the new travel content provider who left their big corporate jobs, and they decided, I can work remote, I'm going to stay remote, and now I want to get more into travel because they are actually are traveling. So I think maybe that type of traveler or that type of content provider maybe wasn't present at SATW, since you have to, you know, jump through several circles, hoops to get to this level. But I do think there's going to be some new blood for sure. Just, you know, it'll take a few years to get to this level, but I'd be interested. Are either of you going to TBEX, and maybe you'll feel a little bit of the vibe for that there?
I've currently no plans to go.
Are they having it? They're having it, I think. They're having it.
Yeah, it's in Washington. I think I got an email today. But given the nature of what I'm doing now, I mean, one of the things I had when I went to SATW, and last year they did a virtual like meetup, is I have no clue what, you know, destinations have for budgets, what they're looking for. Everything's still up in the air at this point. So, and given what I'm doing now, doing a daily podcast, there's going to have to be a compelling reason for me to go to a conference at this point. Because even just going down to Milwaukee, which is 2 hours, not even 90 minutes from where I live, I basically had to queue up weeks worth of past shows, and it's a big thing for me now. So I don't foresee myself going to as many conferences as I did in the past, just based on what I'm doing now.
Well, maybe not for the conferences, but maybe there's something that we can do to help destinations. And I know, Gary, you and I have talked about it lots of times before, and even with Chris in the past. If there are destinations listening from SATW or elsewhere, Gary and I love doing live shows. We love doing live shows. We are happy to come to a certain location and do the show from there and talk about the specific destination. But Mary Jo, what was your biggest takeaway from SATW in terms of, did you learn anything? Did you meet anybody? Was there still that great networking vibe that we get from past conferences?
Yeah, there's always a networking vibe at conferences. And I think when you've been doing this as long as, you know, the three of us have, you don't look for your takeaways to be these huge, momentous epiphanies. They're just little nibbles of information that you sort of file away, or a tiny aha moment. And I certainly got many of those that I will be taking a closer look at and thinking about. And we'll see if they fit my business models or if it's something I want to incorporate. But so I'm not looking for the big ahas. I'm looking for the little small nibbles or bits that give me something to think about and act on.
Well, they usually happen in the hotel lobby room or at the bar or in the lunch at the lunch table when you're sitting with somebody that you haven't met before.
Or over in a German dinner in Milwaukee.
There you go. Yes, tell us, both of you, tell me more about Milwaukee. I love Milwaukee, and I've been there a few times. I actually wanted to move there had I not met my husband, because I went through there when I was on book tour for Sand in My Bra, the Sand in My Bra series, and I loved it there. But what did you get to see any of Milwaukee? Did you get out of the conference halls? Did you go on any day trips?
Well, for me, it was my first trip to Milwaukee. I technically had been on the ground there. I was diverted there and sat on a runway when there was weather in Chicago. But this was my first time visiting the city. Because I was on the board of directors, I had a lot of required responsibilities. But my husband met me there, and we stayed on through the weekend and got to do some exploration on our own. And that was really enjoyable. Gary, however, is the expert on the city, since he's lived in Wisconsin all of his life, except when he was nomadic. And we got some good recommendations from him as far as what to do.
I'm not really an expert. This was my first, believe it or not, this is the first time I'd actually stayed overnight in Milwaukee ever. There was just never a reason to do so before. And I'd never really spent a lot of time in downtown Milwaukee. You know, growing up, if we went to Milwaukee, it was to go watch the Brewers play. And then you'd go and you'd go home, and or you'd go to the zoo or something like that. And Milwaukee is a very different city than when I was growing up. It was kind of your typical Rust Belt type Midwestern city in the 70s and 80s. So it was a place that, you know, no one ever really wanted to visit. And today it's a very different city. It's a lot cleaner. It's a lot nicer. They have a bunch of new things. So I was pleasantly pleased by it. And I think having grown up in Wisconsin, it was a very different, my attitude towards the place was very different. I told this to the people at Visit Milwaukee. It was like, you know, growing up, you know, and I think there's always an element of this, that whenever you're in a state that has one major city, people who don't live in that city kind of don't like it. That's kind of true everywhere. Like, I'm sure in Washington, there are people who live in outstate Washington just hate Seattle because,
yeah,
you know, that's true everywhere. And the same is kind of true with Wisconsin. But I enjoyed it, and it was very nice. And I'll probably be going back at some point, especially because, you know, it's very easy for me to get to. And the other thing I did that I've never really done before in the United States is I took a bus. It was the bus station in downtown Milwaukee was like, you know, 15 minutes from the hotel. And when you factor in the cost of parking and gas, especially with gas prices being really high right now, it was kind of a no-brainer. So it was a $25 ticket each way. So I just took the bus, and I've never really done a whole lot of bus travel in the United States before. So that was kind of different. But this was the first time I'd really been anywhere in a year and a half, you know, that I was in a hotel room or, you know, anywhere other than just cooped up at home. So
were you happy, Gary? Did it feel good? Did you feel alive, did it feel different?
No, I was glad to be doing something different for a while. It was a break from what I've been doing. And I do want to definitely go someplace else at some point. I've been looking at going back to the Pacific. If I travel going forward, it's going to be very different than what I did before the pandemic. I did a lot of running around, taking photos, go here to there. I envision myself staying in one place for longer stays, working on my podcast while I'm there, and then maybe going somewhere else. But still a long way from that point yet. The other thing I thought was interesting is they obviously had a lot of rules in place for COVID. So everyone had to either be vaccinated or have a very recent test. I think everybody, I don't know of anyone that wasn't vaccinated. I don't know if you met anyone, Mary Jo, but everyone I talked to was vaccinated.
Yeah, same.
So that wasn't a problem. But then they had, you know, you had to wear a mask at all of the events. Well, most of the events had food and drink. And it very quickly became, I don't know, I thought it was kind of a joke. Like, you wore the mask, but if you had a drink in your hand, then somehow you didn't have to wear a mask. And, you know, a drink in your hand makes you not transmit COVID or something. So I don't know. I thought that was kind of, and there was a lot of people that eventually just sort of gave up on it at the end. But yeah, it was nice to just do something different for a change. And it's kind of amazing, you know, of all the travels I've done everywhere in the world, that taking a bus trip to Milwaukee, Wisconsin was going to be such a seminal event for me.
Who was the keynote speaker? And tell me a little bit more about who else was speaking besides yourself, Gary.
Mary Jo, no more than me, because she was helping with professional development stuff.
Right. And you know how quickly I put that on the back burner once I was done? the keynote, one of the keynote speakers, and now I'm going to draw a blank on her name, but it's from No Studios, which is owned by the director who did 12 Years a Slave. And this is his sister's who was involved in the company. She left Wall Street to join the company, and they focus on, you know, the 25 words or less version is basically bringing diversity to the arts in the Milwaukee area.
Interesting.
Yeah, I mean, other than that, it was a lot of kind of, you know, things you'd see at similar events. But to be honest, I didn't even attend a lot of the sessions because I spent most of my time working on mine, on my presentation. So,
well, we know how that goes. Did they disclose where next year's is going to be? And did you already say that and I missed it?
We didn't say it, but yes, it was announced it will be in Bogota, Colombia.
Really? Wow.
Yes.
Wow. Maybe I'll have to earn some points or something so that I can get back in SATW. I don't have enough points. Gary, are we ready to switch gears?
Yeah, we might as well. Yeah, the reason we got Mary Jo on the show is you got a new book out, Secret Seattle. And I have to confess, before we start a discussion of Seattle, there's a bunch of cities in the United States that I've been to several times. I've been to Seattle many times. But pretty much every time I'm in Seattle, I'm there for business or I'm just, you know, I'm passing through. So I've never really done a lot of touristy stuff in Seattle. San Francisco is kind of the same way. New York, several major cities that I've been to, but I can't say that I've really explored it. Let's start with what was the genesis of the book? Where did it start from? I mean, obviously you live in Seattle, so we should also mention that.
Right. Yes. I've lived in the area all of my life. And, you know, I never wanted to write a book. So this wasn't something that was some burning desire that I had in pursuit of path. I had coffee one day with Josh Stevens, who's the owner of Reedy Press. I knew him through SCTW. He was passing through town. He suggested we get together, and we did. It was great getting to know a fellow travel lover, and he talked a little bit about his publishing company, and that was it. Didn't seem like anything that I would be interested in pursuing. Well, you know, COVID and not traveling anywhere, and I'm starting to realize that I can't even go to a lot of places here at home, but I'm appreciating the ones that I can. And all of a sudden, writing a book, and specifically this book about Seattle, seemed like a fun idea. So I contacted him, jumped in, and made it work.
Terrific. And so you did it all in, how long did it take you?
Well, it took me a lot longer because of COVID than it might otherwise have, because things were closed or things were changing and I would just have some great ideas for an entry and then COVID changed that. So I think I started working late summer and finished it up in March, I believe.
Well, it's not just some quick ebook. You have several pages, many chapters. Tell us how you organized the book, and are they all short little stories or just tips? Or tell us the organization of the book.
Well, here's the great thing about adding a book to a series. The organization is already decided for you. So I am so thankful that I didn't have to go and do all of that. Basically, it is 84 vignettes about something unusual about Seattle. The subtitle is A Guide to the Weird, Wonderful, and Obscure, which Seattle has plenty of. So I was able to include some of our, kind of sketchy history that maybe things weren't the way we were always told they would be, some unusual locations, and just some unusual facts and backgrounds about some of the more common locations.
Well, Mary Jo, since it's Halloween, can you tell us a little bit about the haunted brothel?
Oh, yes, because who doesn't love a good haunting, especially when it's in a brothel? I've heard a lot about, you know, places that are haunted around here, and I never have really given it a whole lot of thought. But the one that I've probably heard the most about is the Merchant's Cafe, which sounds perfectly respectable, and it is. But that's one of the places that has a real sketchy past. At one time, it was a brothel back in the early days of Seattle when we were just finding our way. We were a pretty rough and tumble kind of town, and it was a brothel. They had rooms where seamstresses, and that would be seamstresses in big quotes, happened to work. They had their pictures hanging at the back of the saloon, which is what it was then, and gentlemen could pick their seamstress. Now, it's rumored that, and some of these portraits are actually still in the back of the cafe today, which is kind of fun. And it's rumored that one of the women haunts the women's bathroom at the cafe today.
Wow. Wow. And it looks like now these rooms are private apartments.
Yes, it's gone through a variety of incarnations in terms of what it's going to be. But they're currently using for housing, for legitimate housing, not for seamstress housing.
Cool. And give us a couple things that were some of your favorites, like, in doing this book, I'm sure you found out more about Seattle than you even knew about your own backyard.
What I couldn't imagine, because I've lived here all my life, and, you know, something new I might not know about. But it was amazing how many times when my husband and I were driving around, we would say to one another, I didn't know this. I didn't know this was here. So it's amazing how much you don't know about your own backyard until you start researching. One of my favorite places was the Communications Museum. And it's in a substation, if that's the right word, for a call center for the phone company. And upstairs is, I would call it a museum, except a museum to me means somewhat organized and curated. And this is really more displays of every imaginable communication device, going back to the World's Fair, when the hot rumor there was that someday there would be, mobile phones, and we'd be able to see each other when we were talking. I mean, that was hot news back during the World's Fair. They have switchboards, they have cables, they have information about the phone lady. It was just everyday things that we take for granted in a wonderful display that was just sort of fun. And it was curated and collected by people who are really passionate about telephony. And it was really fun and really interesting.
I'm scrolling through the rest of your table of contents.
Okay.
And let's see what else pops out. Let's get metaphysical. Page 38.
This was really fun. And this was one of the bookstores that I knew existed because I had remember seeing it a long, 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 long time ago at the Place Market. Well, it turns out it is relocated several times. And it was a difficult setting up this appointment to visit because I think the owner was a little skeptical about what my motivation was. It's actually a library, not a bookstore. It's not for sale. You private library, you pay to join and then you can check out books. They have an incredible collection on alternate theories of the universe, UFOs. They've got one of the largest collection of Dianetics books. They talk about the physical. If you've got a conspiracy theory you want to research, this is your book or this is your library. So it was fascinating the types of literature that they had and the demand for that type of research.
Yeah, and UFOs are it's becoming a hot topic again.
It is.
Right? And a little bit less conspiracy theory as it's coming out in mainstream news.
Yes, exactly.
So hopefully they're getting some good press as well. So were there, I'm not seeing this in the table of contents because the names are so catchy. but was there anything secretive or interesting around the Pike's Place market?
Well, most of the stuff in the Pike Place market is fairly well known. I mean, it's been around for 100 years. And so, you know, most of the little spots have been discovered and everyone's got their favorites. I'm going to get the page number here of, you know, when I go to the market, I have the places that I go. So I rarely go to other locations. Mm-hmm. But doing that, you know, you really do cut off some of the discoveries. And one of those for me was on, it's booth 424. So there's no way to give directions to the market. You just need to look on a map once you get there. And it's called a Giant Shoe Museum. Now, Gary, I think you did a podcast episode about Robert Wadlow, who was reported to be one of the tallest men in the world. Well, he also wore a size 37 AA shoe. And several, it's like a carny peep show where you put in a quarter and then you sort of look in through the window. And I never knew it was there. And it has been there forever. And it's one of those kitschy, retro, fun kind of things. And that led me on a rabbit hole of researching Robert Wadlow and who he is and how did his shoes get found there. And it was just sort of one of those weird, wacky little things that I wouldn't have known if I hadn't been researching for this book.
I'm also looking at Mary Jo. Gary.
Oh, he's the tallest man ever that we know. He was almost 9 feet tall.
8 feet, 11 inches.
Yep. The other one I wanted you to tell us a little bit about was Bruce Lee's favorite restaurant.
Well, it's funny because I actually had to explain who Bruce Lee was to someone who was helping to edit the book. So I guess I take for granted whether that's out of that might be my age.
I was going to say, he or she half our age?
Yeah, I don't know. But I appreciate her pointing out that not everyone would know who it was. He is a martial artist. He was a movie star, well-known during a particular era. He moved to Seattle in 1959 and worked in a Chinese restaurant in the International District, which is what we, at the time, it was referred to as Chinatown and now is referred to as the International District. Well, he made many, you know, he had to work his way through college and he made many contacts during that time. And he worked at a Chinese restaurant. He remained very loyal to the community there and would frequently be seen at Tai Tung restaurant. And that was, he always said that was his favorite Chinese restaurant in the city. He was a regular. His favorite dishes were oyster sauce beef and garlic shrimp. They actually have a booth sort of dedicated to him. I remember during college, that was the place to go because at the time they were open very, very late. And as students studying into the wee hours, you always could go through and get Chinese for pickup and never knowing that it was had a Bruce Lee connection.
But they got the sign back. Right. I'm reading your chapter and it says they lost it to a remodel in the 60s.
Yeah. This is some history that I think has some big blanks that no one's willing to fill in. You know, one time chop suey was the phrase was seen as derogatory and sort of a slam both against, you know, Chinese food in general and against the Chinese people in general. And so, the sign sort of went missing, got lost. And I don't really know if that was deliberate or not. And I'm not sure it matters because the community really rallied around that sign. I mean, it was such iconic sign in the ID. And it's back.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm half Chinese. I don't take offense to it. Maybe that's because I'm not all Chinese. I don't know.
I don't know. I wouldn't presume to speak to that. That's way more complicated. But it does represent the community, and they're very pleased to have it back.
Great.
Chop suey isn't actually a Chinese dish. It's really an Americanized Chinese dish.
Like, is it a name for chow mein? Is it like a slangy American name for chow mein?
No, it was originally just what they used to say food made whatever is local and available and cheap. So it was sort of a generic, like saying casserole almost. I mean,
okay.
It's got many definitions. So it was very much an eating local kind of phrase. And there, you know, at some point it became somewhat politicized, and it was felt that it promoted a racist sentiment rather than anything culinary. So there's a variety of discussions about that, and that's why I don't think we'll ever know the true story with all the political permutations. But we're just happy to see the sign back, because whenever I walk through the ID, it still makes me smile. And when we're there, we're fairly regularly loyal to Tai Tung.
Yay! Terrific.
Just kind of to go off topic for a second, if you want a really interesting video, I think it's BuzzFeed did a YouTube series where they got some people from China and they served them Panda Express to get their reactions.
And most
of them, to them, it was not Chinese food. That this was not something that they would eat, you know, like beef and broccoli. That's an Americanized, you know, type Chinese dish. So they didn't necessarily think it was bad, but they didn't recognize it as, you know, as Chinese food. So it's kind of, they do a whole series of these where they will take, you know, Taco Bell and give it to someone from Mexico to get the reaction of what they think of it. Or they will do the opposite and give American food to someone in a different country to get their reaction of it. So I don't know, just kind of interesting.
Well, I confess,
nothing really new,
we eat Panda Express kind of regularly because it's my daughter's favorite.
I've been guilty a time or two. So,
well, Mary Jo, go ahead, Gary.
Oh, I was just going to ask. So someone's coming to Seattle for the first time, just like you recently went to Milwaukee. What would you give them if they're going to be spending, let's say, an extended weekend? They got 2 full days to go explore the city. Is it just go to the fish market, go up the Space Needle? I mean,
Well, I wouldn't rule those out. My first recommendation would be to stay downtown. Seattle is not easily navigable without a car. And on the other hand, you don't want to spend all your time in the car going from place to place. And so many people that I talked to were planning something way up north and then on the east side. And you know, you're spending all your time traveling and you're not enjoying. So my first tip would be stay downtown, because once downtown, you're either going to be walkable, you can take the monorail, or you can take the public transportation or metro system. And I think for a first visit, you know, if you don't have to factor business or family or any of that information in, really just focus on downtown in terms of what you're seeing. You know, when I wrote this book, I went up in the Space Needle for the first time in a long time. It's the kind of thing that I don't want to say don't do it. And for me, it was somewhat nostalgic because I did go up during the World's Fair. So you can quickly calculate how old I must be. I'm not saying don't do it, but I wouldn't say it's one of my top things to do. The same could be said for the Pike Place Market. I actually go there to shop rather than to sightsee. But, you know, for a lot of people, visiting and seeing them throw fish, which they don't do anymore, so you might want to skip it, or to go to the original Starbucks. I mean, and those are high on people's to-do list. And if those are what you want to do, then by all means, do them. My recommendations, though, is those are usually the must-dos that I hear on people's lists. So getting those out of the way. I mean, the things that I really like is I do like exploring the Seattle Center campus, which is where the Space Needle is located. The Chihuly Glass Museum there, is truly spectacular. It can be done in a relatively short period of time, and it's included in City Pass. If someone is getting a City Pass to do the high points, I think it's well worth the time and well worth the expense if you're just paying for it outright. The other thing is riding the monorail, which seems very ho-hum with light rail everywhere. But putting it in perspective, that was built for the World's Fair. And that seems so long ago, but yet was sort of a precursor to so many things we take for granted, and was a form of light rail mass transportation for that era. The other thing is I do also recommend walking around the ID, the International District. We are a melting pot of Asia, and just stopping at, you know, any little hole in the wall restaurant will yield great food. It's a perfect thing to do for lunch. There's so many things to see historically. It's not always representative of a good time in our history. Washington does have a rather difficult period of history from the Japanese internment. And there are a lot of stories there that are worth exploring and worth telling. So for history buffs, I definitely recommend that. And the same can be said for Pioneer Square, where our history with the Native Americans who lived here before us enjoy a little not quite accurate storytelling, but there are lots of resources for discovery. And then finally, I guess, and this is probably a little bit more touristy, enjoy the Seattle waterfront. There's everything from kitschy places like Ye Olde Curiosity Shop to just simply walking and having great seafood. You know, take your unstructured time, especially if you're here during the nice weather, and just being outdoors and seeing the Puget Sound.
Oh, it sounds like a lovely getaway. And I didn't even know about the ID area that you're talking about. Had no idea. But I haven't been to Seattle in years. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about seasons and times to visit. And we know you guys get lots of rain. And so, you know, maybe we want to come during the rain when it's all moody and maybe somebody else is going to write a book by looking off at the coast.
Well, I'd like to say that the rain is overrated or overstated, but it's not. Miami, however, actually gets more rain than we do. They just get all of it in just one giant spurt. And we like ours to linger longer, like 9 months. So it's true. Much of the time in Seattle, it may not be pouring down rain, but it's got that lingering, drizzling, misty, gray, somewhat depressing kind of weather. Living here, I know that I can always escape, so it usually doesn't bother me. But if that's going to make a bad vacation experience for you, then just wait and come during the summer. I mean, don't set yourself up for failure. Our summers and fall are really nice. I mean, it's lovely here right now. It's probably in the mid-50s, but the sun is out. It might be, you know, chilly and need a coat, but it's dry. It's beautiful. It's much less travel time, so you don't have a lot of tourists to cope with. However, if you're willing to come off season, if you can tolerate the rain, bring an umbrella or a raincoat, you'll find much better prices with hotels, no surprise. You'll find things less crowded. Yeah, you know, might have to make a few adjustments. If you're going to do indoors and explore some historical sites, you're going to be indoors anyway, so the rain doesn't really matter. And, you know, we just get used to it. And if you can make those adjustments, off season is a wonderful time to be here. You know, during the summer, we also have a very busy cruise business here out of here. Several cruise lines make this as a port of call, and cruises start and end here. So it's going to be busy. It's going to be hectic when those ships are in port. People add on pre and post time after their cruise. And hotel prices skyrocket. So if you need to be here during that time, by all means, come. It's great. But if you can avoid it, you can save yourself some money in the off season.
Have the cruises returned?
They have. They started cruising, I want to say, in early to mid-July.
All right. With anything else, let's move on to our picks of the week then. Jen, do you have anything for us?
I do. We were talking about Milwaukee, so I wanted to tell everybody about this pretty cool hotel that I stayed at ages ago, and it had an Art Deco theme to it. It's called the Ambassador Hotel in Milwaukee. And I looked, and it is still alive and well, and they've just got such neat decor in the elevators and the bars. And I don't remember. The rooms are more, you know, traditional, contemporary, elegant type boutique hotel style. But the building and the accents and the dining areas, really, really fantastic, and take you back to that Art Deco theme, which you don't get to see that often. So, yes, check out the Fitz inside the Ambassador Hotel, the Deco Cafe, if you're not staying there. And they have a new outdoor area for, you know, COVID-conscious people, but you got to go see those cool, cool Art Deco details.
All right. Mary Jo, do you have anything for us?
I do. And we were just talking about cruising, which actually ties into my my pick, which is vesselfinder.com. I've got a cruise coming up, and I know that the ship is currently in Europe and will eventually be making its way across the Atlantic. So I went there to check, and you can find out exactly where any ship is. And that includes not only like a passenger cruise ship, but cargo ship and everything. You can just search by ship or by port, and you can find where a ship is. And I knew they had these for planes, and I've seen the maps, but I discovered this one for ships, and I've kind of been having some fun playing with it.
Okay, this is actually really cool.
let me guess, Starlink.
No, but it's like it's a map of the world, and it shows you where all the ships are.
Yeah, it's really fun.
Because if you zoom in on Los Angeles, or more accurately, Long Beach, there is just a massive clot of ships there right now that are all waiting to get unloaded. So if you wanted to see how the supply chain problems are actually manifesting themselves, this is a great way to visualize it.
Yeah, it's pretty crowded. Are all
these
down there.
Okay, so I'm on vesselfinder.com as well. Are all these yellow and orange and blue ships and pink ships current? This is currently what our oceans look like right now?
Right.
Well, yes, but they're not to scale. I mean, this looks really busy, but you got to remember that each one of these arrows is the size of Rhode Island or, you know, something like that. So they're not that big. I mean, you're going to go on the open ocean and, you know, you're probably not even going to see one of these. You wouldn't see a ship at all unless you were right next to it.
And it's real time. It's updated. I mean, when I pull something up, it has just updated within the last 1 or 2 minutes. So if a ship is going from one port to another, you know, it'll show you the last port it's left, where it's due, if it's just moored or docked, if it's just hanging out in Long Beach.
Wow. And these ships are massive. They're so big.
Well, now I'm kind of curious as to how all this data is being processed. Because there has to be some sort of central clearinghouse for all of this information. So I'm going to probably spend some time on this. I'm looking at like Antarctica, and the Antarctic season hasn't started yet, but you can still sort of see some ships that are rounding around, you know, going around Cape Horn and some in Ushuaia and stuff like that. So yeah. That's neat.
Well, the Atlantic looks chock-a-block too.
Well, yeah, because, again, these are all not drawn to scale. So if you there's always a lot. The same's true with airplanes, right? You know, there's I think at any given moment, 10,000 planes in the sky, or at least like pre-pandemic there was. But if you look at a map, that looks like it's huge. But in reality, you know, maybe you might see one airplane if you're on an airplane, you know, somewhere else. But that's it. All right.
Thanks,
my pick
that's
this week.
That's cool. Yeah.
my pick this week, it's actually just going to be a recommendation for something to do. Now, Jen has been talking about Bitcoin stuff. She's the, you know, bit curious mom. And I have kind of not, you know, I kind of pride myself on being pretty cutting edge with a lot of technology, but I've always ignored this, the Bitcoin stuff. Kind of wish I hadn't, kind of wish I had paid more attention to it 10 years ago. I'd be a billionaire now, but so I started doing that a few months ago. And the one thing I would recommend everyone to do is to take.
Go on, Gary, go on.
Take $20 and put it. See, I mean, and here's the other thing. I think everyone, when they hear of Bitcoin, if you don't know anything about it, all you hear about is what's on the news. And the only thing they ever talk about is the price. And that's really kind of disingenuous because you don't buy one Bitcoin, right? And we use that. We use the term Bitcoin generically, and a Bitcoin, they're very different things. Like a Bitcoin is close to $60,000, but you don't have to. You can, you know, subdivide a Bitcoin however you want. So get a wallet, some wallet on whatever your smartphone is. There's all kinds of wallets that are available, and put $20, you know, an amount that you could very easily lose and play around with, into something that has a Lightning wallet. It has to be Lightning, because Lightning is a layer on top of Bitcoin that allows you to make very small and very quick transactions. And as I've been doing more research into this, I'm realizing, you know, the average person listening to this, if you're living in the United States or a developed country, you really have no day-to-day need for Bitcoin. But where it's actually starting to be used in day-to-day transactions are in developing countries where they send remittances back and they have a very poor banking system and very poor currencies. This is starting to be used every day for transactions between regular people. And it also can be used now for doing microtransactions online, where you can literally get access to a blog post or even pay for podcasts. And you can do it very quick, very efficiently for as little as a few pennies. You can't efficiently do a 10-cent transaction with credit cards because of the overhead and, you know, the fees and everything else. It doesn't make sense. But you can actually do that with Satoshis. And a Satoshi is just 1/100,000,000th of a Bitcoin. And I think that's going to be the usage that most people in developing countries have for it, and that it's going to allow for micropayments online, because that really has not been something that has been possible before. So, yeah, just try it out.
Gary, I absolutely love that you're talking about this and that you're exploring this. And so your tip, kind of generic, was get a Lightning wallet. So I am going to fill in the blanks with that with an article that reviews a few different Lightning wallets. But I also want you, because our listeners love it when you and I fight a little bit. Do you remember, like, 5, 6, maybe it was 8 years ago. If Chris is listening, I know he remembers. We interviewed a guy who traveled around the world only on Bitcoin. Now, it's ages back. It was like within it. It had to have been in like 2016 or 17. And we interviewed this guy back even before I knew what was going on. I just knew I was so excited about it. And do you remember that interview vaguely? Because he must have had a hell of a time back then trying to cash his coin for trying to change in his coin for money to stay at the hostels and stuff.
Yeah, it was very difficult. And to be honest, that was always my problem with Bitcoin, is that it doesn't really work well. His name was Felix Weiss.
That's right.
From Bitcoin Traveler. It's very difficult to actually use Bitcoin proper as a form of currency, because you can't run that many transactions. But the Lightning Network, which is basically like a series of tabs that you have set up. So if it exists, instead of an IOU, though, you're just kind of like putting money down in advance. And that's how you're able to get so many small transactions and have it, you know, done so quickly.
Didn't you say you set up a This Weekend Travel tipping thing for us?
No one's really used it yet. I mean,
that's okay. We have to tell them the handle so that they can do it. Even
well, it's not a handle. It's just there's only a couple apps, podcast apps, that will let you send Bitcoin within it. There's a brand new one called Fountain, which is available on iOS and Android, and there's another one called Breeze, which is available on Android, and you got to do some stuff to get it to run on iOS. So it's not really mainstream right now.
I want to add a line to our show notes: how to tip Gary and Jen in Bitcoin. So what is the address that we give them?
It's not an address. It's just when you're the podcast has to be set up to do it, and I've already done that. So it works off podcast. We'd have to do a whole episode on this.
Okay.
This was all kind of done by Adam Curry. If you remember, he was one of the original MTV VJs. He was also the guy that did the name podcasting, and he's been working on this project, and I've been kind of in their group. This thing called Value for Value that basically allows it to easily do this. And they set up a thing called podcastindex.org, which is an index of podcasts that is outside of Apple or any third party. And within that, you set it up to some sort of wallet. And I've already done that. So it's already hooked up. But the trick is you have to have a app that works. And there just aren't many of them right now. There's no like Apple, Spotify, Google, none of that does it. You have to have one of these very niche apps.
All right. Well, we're going to put our minds together, and I'm going to see what you have so far and what we have to do it, because I am determined to at least start the tipping process so I can see it work, because we have talked about it a couple of times. But I definitely want to see how it goes. And
we can talk offline. I can show you.
Yeah, we'll do it offline.
And then let me know how it goes, because Gary and I have been talking about this, and I'm stuck back in the practical, and I'm not yet where he is in the theoretical future of it. So I want to know how it goes.
Okay.
No, we are where we are with Bitcoin, I think, like in the late 90s, where the internet was. Where you still had to explain people, this is what a URL is, and this is what a link is. everyone had to go through that, right? There was a point where we didn't know what that stuff was, and then we learned about it. Now we know it. And there's also the same learning process that I think people have to go through. And there are new tools coming out all the time. It's becoming easier to do this. It's still not super easy if you want to do this as a, something that you can actually use as a form of payment, but it is getting a lot easier. And I think for people who travel, so El Salvador has made this an official currency. It's a legal tender. The same is being debated right now in Paraguay, Panama, and Brazil. And I'm guessing that it's going to happen or may happen in a couple African countries as well. It's de facto being used, in some communities in like Nigeria and other places where they see a lot of remittances.
And imminently in the Ukraine as well.
Yeah. And then they've been talking about it. So for when people travel, I think this might be something to at least think about, to maybe have a couple hundred dollars in a wallet somewhere that if you should need it, this would maybe serve as like a modern day version of a traveler's check, emergency currency or something that's there. Or if you at least have a wallet set up and you are stranded somewhere, this would be a very, very easy way to send payments. I don't know if that's ever happened to you where you've been stuck somewhere and you needed money.
I've actually paid people who have been stuck. I've done it from the other end. So I've had people that were short on cash or couldn't access their funds from their bank. And I said, hold on, I've got Bitcoin in my Cash App and I can get that to you. So, but Gary, I love, love, love your enthusiasm on this. And just since we're talking about it, if anybody's still listening to this, and listening to our discussion on this, this is actually what I do now. Because it's more than just Bitcoin. It's a big cryptocurrency space, and the mainstream is getting in through art and media and NFTs and everything. And so what I do is I coach people who want to get their start in cryptos, and I specialize in doing it just for women. And so I have daily curated content for them, a community on Telegram, and I do weekly Zooms where I have coaching sessions just in an all-women's group where I can help people and they can ask me their questions. They talk about what they're doing and we help them that way. And then I also do private one-on-one sessions because, believe it or not, the space, like Gary says, it's kind of like we're back in the 90s with the internet. For people who don't know the language and people who don't know what all this is, but they want to be a part of it. Sometimes people want a little hand holding, like if they're unboxing their hardware wallet, their Ledger or their Trezor. And that's where I come in, and I try to help people out that way. So thank you for that self plug.
All right. And we're running late, so let's wrap things up. Jen, where can people find you online?
Well, you can find me online, like we were talking about, at Bit Curious Mom and at Bit Curious Mom, and on Twitter at Jen Leo. But before we get to Mary Jo, when you say where you are, Mary Jo, please also tell us where your book is available, Secret Seattle.
Thanks, Jen. You can find me at travelingwithmj.com. That's my main blog, and everything sort of spears out from there. And you can get more information about the book as well as information about where you can buy the book at secretseattlebook.com.
Excellent. And is it available like at airports or any other touristy locations in Seattle yet?
When I was last out looking, it hadn't yet arrived. But as I said, this was just released right before I was getting ready to leave for SATW. So I see that they've made purchases. So I'm assuming it probably is back and I just need to do another round and check. So you should be able to find it in local Seattle bookstores as well as the big box retailers and Amazon.
Excellent. And as usual, you can find me at the Everything Everywhere Daily Podcast, which is available wherever you're listening to this show. And until next time, stay tuned for another episode of This Week in Travel.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe and leave a review wherever you get your podcasts.